Hey, before we talk about genre, let's talk about this book.
Yes,
Predictive Analytics by Dr. Eric Siegel.
Do you are you okay with Eric, or should we call you Doctor?
Dr. Siegel.
I would prefer Eric. I'm an old friend of Bill's. Been listening to the show for 2.5 years without fail. More recent decades, friends with Emily, and have the pleasure of meeting Steve today. I'm a huge fan of the show. I think you guys do great stuff. One of the top three sources for me in current events. I read Huffington Post ad hoc when I have a chance. I floss when I watch The Daily Show. And then there's this.
Oh, go on.
It's true.
No, really, go on.
Okay.
Keep going. So, Eric, your book is doing well. Is it doing well?
Yes, it's doing quite well. It's been the number one category bestseller in 2 categories on Amazon. It launched in February. And, you know, the book is meant for all readers. It's a technical topic. It's about a kind of technology, predictive analytics, which is technology that learns from data to make predictions for each individual person. So for customers, voters, the Obama campaign used it, for healthcare patients, for law enforcement suspects who may be investigated based on their predictive scores, for incarcerated felons where parole boards are making decisions. All cases where there's data, and data is experience. Data is not a boring thing. If you're out there and you think data is boring, it's because you're forgetting that it's actually a recording of things that have happened, and it's extremely powerful because you can learn from it how to make these predictions across all these different kinds of sectors, government and business.
So where in the book does it talk about precogs in a tub predicting murders?
I was on Bloomberg too, actually, yeah. and they actually started showing that. I talk a little bit. I may draw that analogy. So the main difference from what happens in the movie Minority Report, Steven Spielberg and Tom Cruise, and Colin Farrell charges at Tom Cruise and says, "You ever get any false positives?"
Yeah,
and they're all mano a mano. And that is the issue.
Yeah.
The difference is that this is decisions. In the case of something that important, does somebody stay in prison? It's somebody who's already been convicted. It's whether to release them or for a judge how long to sentence them. And it's decision support rather than a fully automated thing where you're completely trusting a system. You're providing the output of the system to a human decision maker. However, there will be cases where it's the deciding factor, inevitably. And amongst those, there will be cases where it's wrong. So there are crime-predicting computers that are leaving people, by some definition, unfairly in prison.
You know, in my world, in politics and campaigns, and data nerds are all of a sudden very popular people.
Yes.
I mean, they are in vogue. They are making big money. They are in demand. I don't mean just Nate Silver. I mean folks who are – I mean the data nerds that the Obama campaign hired, that was an army.
Yep. They had more than 50, I think.
Right, and dwarfed Republicans. I mean, Republicans have been way behind on the whole idea of data analytics and data value. I mean, data management to them was just something that accounting firms dealt with.
Right.
But because the data nerds were so important and influential and powerful in the Obama campaign...
Steve's using the word nerd in a not non-pejorative
sense. No, I mean, hell. I love data
nerds. We prefer geek.
Well, so the data folks
yeah.
that the Obama campaign hired, I mean, they kind of revolutionized, they created a field, I think it's fair to say.
Oh, yeah, it's a game changer for real. I mean, and it'll go beyond the United States. You know, Australia's looking at it, and it'll go beyond presidential. But when the stakes are as high as presidential and there's that much data and it applies over that many voters, it's definitely, you know, we're looking a few years ahead to the next presidential campaign. It'll be very interesting to see. Of course, everyone wonders whether the Republicans will rally.
They're trying.
Hard to imagine they'll catch up, though, in terms of this, the use of this technology.
Do you consider it a positive thing? I know that, for example, micro-targeting, when the data geeks got together and started digging in on from the purposes of micro-targeting, some people got a little freaked out. That there was too much information out there to help a campaign target literally a household on a specific block in Cleveland that was considered important. So, I mean, do you think that is it all positive or is it all negative somewhere in between in terms of privacy, in terms of access to voter information in the hands of a campaign. Do you see any problems there, or do you not, or is it fine?
No, I have to be agnostic on that because it's such a tricky issue. So just to paint the backstory a little bit more, you know, people are familiar with poll aggregators such as Nate Silver, and that's really the difference between forecasting, which is a well-known thing, how many people are going to buy this product, how many people are going to vote for our candidate within a certain state like Ohio. That's what Nate Silver did, was forecasting. So he competed publicly to win at predicting, whereas the Obama campaign analytics team competed really quietly to win the election, right? What's more powerful? By making predictions per person, and that's what's different than forecasting, is it's on that level of detail, granularity. By predicting per person, you're directly informing decisions, in the case of a political campaign, whose door to knock on or place of call, the use of this limited resource known as campaign volunteers, and therefore not just to predict the future, but to influence it, because you're driving all those operations over millions of voters in a more effective way. You're making that army of volunteers that much more of a powerful resource. So it's basically just taking the notion of marketing, and you know, a presidential campaign is a marketing campaign, like, you know, you're selling a president rather than a product. But if marketing is an okay way to look at politics, and clearly that's been established over decades, this is just taking the same concept and amping it. So where do you draw the line? When is it becoming more of a marketing scheme rather than about the issues? That was already a dilemma, right? So yeah. There's no easy answer.
It's
to
a
that
little
question.
Bit about how you market it, how you market the marketing. There's an anecdote. This is a sort of a rudimentary example of this technology, but there's an anecdote about how in one election cycle, I don't know who this was, but they would send out. They found it a very powerful motivator that they would send out notices to people, and they would say, hey. 20% of the people on your street voted in the last election, or something like that. We want to let you know that your neighborhood is doing this well, and that people kind of freaked out a little bit about that,
right?
And they reacted negatively to it, and so it's about tweaking the message that sort of engages that sort of shame muscle in people to make them feel like, oh, people are paying attention to what I do. I better go vote, which is really powerful, but not so much that it feels like we're watching you. Exactly. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like that's a messaging thing. That's how you sort of thread the needle to get the person to actually act.
Right.
Based on the data that you have. Does that make any sense?
That definitely makes sense. And another way that can be interpreted as a sort of insidious gesture is that the way the Obama campaign used a particularly advanced form of predictive analytics known as, they called it persuasion modeling, also called uplift modeling. It's predicting persuasion in order to do persuasion. So rather than just targeting by predicting who you're going to vote for, they're predicting who can we influence. Who's the sliver? Forget this concept of swing voters. That's a totally subjective, ill-defined concept. Right. This is, who will we actually increase the chance of swaying our direction, statistically speaking, by making contact? And conversely, who are we going to actually inadvertently swing the opposite? Let's earmark those so we can avoid them. So it's literally house door knock by door knock or phone number by phone number, into the point where they're going right into the middle of a red zone potentially because there's one person potentially influenceable. It completely changes that. But that literally, what does that mean? That means it's the science of mass persuasion. It's a scientific, hard-nosed approach to persuasion where you can, which is limited field. So I don't know. Do people feel okay with that? I mean, that's sort of what marketing was intended to do in the first place, but now it's just taking it to its natural conclusion.
I always tell when people knock on my door, like if an Obama person were to knock on my door,
oh, right.
I'm immediately like, don't waste your time with me. I'm in the bank.
Right.
Go spend time with somebody else.
I can think of so many times people, the campaigns will call me, and I'm like, really?
Yeah.
You're wasting your time calling me?
So in this technology, persuasion modeling or uplift modeling, whether you're marketing or doing presidential campaign, the nomenclature, the vocabulary are sure things, do not disturbs, otherwise known as sleeping dogs. Let sleeping dogs lie. These are the people you might inadvertently switch in the wrong direction. Persuadables or lost causes.
Right.
So it's the lost causes.
Persuadables are the ones
lost causes and sure things, not as a waste of time. Do not disturb sleeping dogs. Definitely, by all, you have to avoid them at all costs. And it's this precious persuadable slice And those are the individuals. They may not all be have things in common. There may be various reasons that they're predicted as potentially persuadable. But those are the things that are precious.
And this is the sea change has happened, right? All future presidential elections hinge on this.
But there's been a lot of reporting done on the data team for the Obama campaign, and they created a new field of exactly what Eric is talking about here.
Well, and what I'm talking about is one part of it, this persuasion modeling. There's also all the web analytics and a lot of more broad things. Just get out the vote for probable voters. So this is sort of just one part of it, but obviously an important part.
Well, right. I mean, 2008, they were doing some of this, but it was rudimentary. But even then, they were no one had ever done this before. No one had ever even thought to try to do the kind of data modeling that the Obama campaign was doing in 08. And then it was just next gen 2012. I saw in Washington Post a report, I think it was about a week or two ago, I don't know if you saw it, that Republicans are saying, we basically woke up the day after the election and said, you know, these data guys killed us. We need to duplicate that. But they can't find conservative data nerds. They just can't. They've reached out to people. And there are all kinds of, you know, data consulting firms and so on. And I know you can speak to that in more detail. But they tend to be liberal just by nature.
So outside of my book, a large amount of my work is as the founder of Predictive Analytics World, which is a commercial conference. And, you know, two of my most important and valued colleagues who are amazing rock star consultants in this area are right wing.
Oh, no
kidding.
And
then many other ones are liberal. And just for the record, I'm liberal.
We figured if you've been listening to this show for 2.5 years,
you might be masochistic and really, oh my God. Stephen Miller are such idiots. Why do I keep listening to this?
The masochistic nerd.
How many iPods have you destroyed, you know, like throwing them at the ground? So those guys are probably in a good space to make some bank.
I would assume
in future elections, I would think.
I mean, they're too busy with working for the government as opposed to and for commercial entities, I think, you know.
Right.
Those two guys in particular, but now the other angle that all this brings up is all the stuff with the NSA. I don't know if you guys
talk
about that. I mean, just data privacy in general obviously has come up once again around that, as it did probably last time it was sort of this big, was Target predicting who's pregnant.
Yeah, that's my favorite story of all time.
It's your favorite story of all time.
When it comes to data predictive models with data, yes, that is my favorite story of all time.
Okay, all right. It's a juicy one. Yeah.
Well, for listeners, I mean, have we talked about this?
We did, because the New York Times interviewed Eric, and then he was on Fox News for this story. Yes.
You're right. We did talk about this.
Yeah.
I was thinking, anyway, go ahead.
Well, more general. I just wanted to open that up if in this or another segment, if you guys want to get into that at all. I mean, basically, prediction kind of amps up the privacy concerns. I mean, if you're concerned about what data exists and who can access it, now we're talking about predicting something, whether you're pregnant, whether you're going to commit a crime again, whether you're going to quit your job like Hewlett-Packard and many large organizations.
Or whether you're going to commit a crime even if you haven't done it before, like the Boston bombers or whatever, you know, like how do you model those things to determine
and within the NSA data, that's the point, right? So the more they have, the more potential there is, the more that resource there is from which to create these predictive models, to learn how to earmark who might be more likely than average to commit a crime.
So until this moment, I had not considered a motivation for the NSA to want to collect everyone's data is not so that they can spy on everyone, but so that they can have a broader baseline from which to make predictions. Right?
Yeah,
let's
spell that out a little more explicitly. You know, in general, the thing you're trying to predict is rare, especially in law enforcement and fraud detection applications. Very rare. So you've got an abundance of negative cases, the innocuous case. That's good. It's good that most people don't commit fraud or crimes. And then this small, precious sliver of the so-called positive cases of actual crimes. The negative cases, any individual negative case is therefore less valuable to the learning process. However, they're all valuable. So you want, in general, from a technology standpoint, you want as much data as possible. In the book, I refer to people on my side in that respect as data hustlers, because we have that incentive with respect to the privacy debate. Just give me as much data as possible, err on the side of more data sitting around, which you know, also expense-wise, is becoming so cheap. So in general, organizations, including government organizations, are going to have that incentive to just collect as much as possible, right? And obviously, that does bring up privacy concerns, but the incentives there, the data hustlers are like rallying for it, pushing for it.
I mean, you think about it, that makes, it's just common sense. I mean, you create better models if you have more data. So there's always this. I mean, Nate has talked about this too, and we're just polling. Give me literally every poll you can get your hands on. Regardless of whether the pollster is any good, we can create a model that can wait for the quality of the pollster. Just give me data. More data, more data, more data. So, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. Although, there's a downside. By the way, there are all these privacy concerns when the NSA is doing it.
Right. I mean, so the privacy concerns largely come up in sort of just this set. It's not a technical question. It's just a question of trust, because there could be an individual who you know, exploits that and who's working at the government agency and just goes and checks out your data because they are on a whim or what have you, right? So it's about those kinds of individual infractions, I suppose. Or what else comes to mind? I mean, people are concerned about this. There's obviously, one way or another, there has to be a privacy or other civil liberty infraction that affects an individual. What is that? I don't hear people spelling it out
on aggregate as well, not just on an individual basis. I mean, there are some basic sort of Fourth Amendment stuff going on, right? Are my emails considered my personal effects? Yeah, I think that they are. So they ought not be seized and searched.
And there's a possibility for a chilling effect if you're maybe, do you send that email that is provocative if you think someone's going to be reading it? Even if you're not a suspect, you might be. The chilling effect might be real. It's arguably real.
You know, there are a couple of different things. I mean, yes, I think that wholesale gathering of information on American citizens ought not be happening by the government, even though we know it's happening sort of through collusion. It's happening via these private entities, right? So yes. I signed Facebook's EULA when I joined them, and the price that I'm paying for using their service is that they get to collect data on me and use it for their own purposes.
Yep.
I signed no such EULA with the United States government, and I don't want them using that. You know what I mean? I don't want Facebook sharing that data without my permission with the government necessarily. It's definitely a little scary that all this that the government, who has an army and has prisons that you can put, like, Facebook's not going to put me in prison, right?
Not yet.
But the government has a lot of power, and so we have to treat them fundamentally differently than we treat corporate actors when it comes to the sorts of power we grant them over us and over our lives. So I think there's a big difference there. But I'm also a big advocate of technology and using technology to fight this. Like really strong email encryption, for example, is trivial in terms of it. Like, it's been around for years, and nobody uses it because it just hasn't sort of caught on. But like, if we all encrypted our emails in PGP when we sent them, then it wouldn't matter that the government was collecting all of the emails, because they couldn't ever be read.
Right.
Well, what could be, you know, you'd still see all the connections, right? You'd see that I sent an email to Eric. You'd see that I sent
exactly
an email
right.
to you,
but you could never see
the content of that without the government going through an amount of work that would be
prohibitive. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, I'd advocate that. I mean, you know, if Gmail tomorrow, and I know this goes against Gmail's model too, but if Gmail tomorrow and it put a plug-in that was like, encrypt your email, you know what I mean? And it would be technologically very easy for them to do that. I bet it would be wildly popular, and this would largely become a moot point around the emails.
For the record, my wife has a background in data management, so she's been kind of, I wouldn't say evangelizing in support of data nerds for many years, but more or less. And so I have an inherent familial interest in finding this interesting, but hearing you talk about this is absolutely captivating. I love it, love it, love it, love it. I can't wait to read your book.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's tough. So I devoted chapter 2 to these ethical questions.
Cool.
All right. Well, Eric, thanks for being here. And
don't leave.
You can, yeah.